bitch, please.
Oh, bitch, please, my ass. You want a sandwich?
Dig that. Oh, hell yeah.
She's a bad man, a gentleman. I'm a black man in a white world. I'm a black man in a white world.
If I wasn't a Christian man, I'd probably be kicking in your ass.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the JB's Low Tech Podcast. Today's guest is an Arthur, and let's say he's a survivor. Here next on the JB's Low Tech Podcast.
When you need someone to listen, a lawyer you know and trust.
Congratulations to all the Minnesota businesses that scraped through the last year. It sure hasn't been easy, but we've done it together. And while we certainly need to move forward, it's good to reflect on what we've been through and the many losses. Here at Bradshaw & Bryant, we held a lot of Zoom meetings, increased our phone calls, and have done our best to keep up with all the changes while continuing to provide quality work. We'd like to thank everyone that turned to us with their personal injury and criminal needs, as well as the courtrooms for bringing the community back together to serve justice. We look forward to being part of Minnesota's growth and success for many years to come. I'm Mike Bryant from Bradshaw & Bryant. I hope you're never injured in a collision, but if you are, don't sign anything till you've talked to us.
Find Bradshaw & Bryant, personal injury attorneys at minnesotapersonalinjury.com.
Seeking justice for the injured, Bradshaw & Bryant.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the JB's Low Tech Podcast. And today's guest is Tommy Watson, motivational speaker, survivor. So, you know, his story is one great one. And he's also an author, I believe, is a father. And he's a friend, and I've known Tommy since he was 18 years old. How you doing, Tommy?
I'm doing great. Almost 30 years, JB. Can you believe that? We're getting old, man. We're getting old.
Well, you got to remember, you feel like you're getting old. Tommy, I am old.
I'll keep that in mind as I go on this journey here. So, yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I turned 59 on Tuesday, so.
Wow. Well, you're looking good, man.
I'm trying.
Yeah, you're aging very well, brother. So, congratulations to you on that.
Yeah. So, where do we find you in this fine country today?
I currently live in Charlotte, North Carolina. I left Minnesota about 8 years ago.
Okay.
I wanted a little warmer climate.
Right.
Blue skies. And in fact, my last year in Minnesota had 53 days below zero.
Oh.
And it even snowed. I believe it was around Mother's Day. And I said it was time for me to definitely get out of that place.
It can happen. But then winters like this past one can happen where it barely snowed. And I noticed other cities like Chicago and St. Louis had it worse. And even some parts of Texas had ice storms and whatnot.
Absolutely. I haven't seen snow in about 2 years, so I'm good.
That's curious. So you probably don't miss it.
Yeah, not at all. I put in my time. I did my time.
Tommy, you have such a motivational story and background. Can you give us a look into your background, how things were when you were raised and whatnot?
Absolutely. You know, JB, again, appreciate you having me on the show.
Sure.
As mentioned, I played football for the University of Minnesota prior to getting to Minnesota in 1992. Life for me growing up in Denver, Colorado was pretty tough. My mother and father were heroin addicts and professional shoplifters. That's what they did for a living. So by the time I finished high school, my mother and father had been arrested 121 times.
Wow.
I was actually homeless my senior year of high school.
Yeah.
As a kid, I spent a lot of time in foster homes, crisis centers, motel rooms, bouncing around from place to place, living with my grandmother several times, living with friends and families. I went to five different elementary schools within 6 years of elementary school, went to two different middle schools within 2 years. And in eighth grade, I was living in a motel room. There was nine of us my entire 3 year school. We just got kicked out of our house in front of all of our friends in the neighborhood. And nine of us moved into our seventh motel room. And I remember during that time saying, this can't be my future. And I stayed involved in sports, ended up meeting a coach from a private suburban Denver high school, came into the inner cities of Denver and talked to me and my friends about the chance, possibly going out to this high school. And he mentioned the word college. And I said, this is going to be my ticket out. And I remember doing everything I had to do while living in that motel room to get my grades together, because my grades were pretty bad prior to that, and got my grades together, got 3.0 in school, on a roll, won an award that was given to a handful of kids in the entire state of Colorado, became a wrestling champ. And lo and behold, I finally went and told my mother and father about this opportunity, and they said, boy, you're not going out to the white school. And I remember saying, wow, I'm in Rome. What am I doing now?
Right.
And in my 3 year of school, they ended up going back to prison again, JB. Mm-hmm. And me and my little brother and little sister moved with my grandmother and moved into the heart of our neighborhood, which is now being called Little Compton. It was my grandmother's wish that I go out to the school and do well. So I went out to, I was taking 3 city buses one way to high school every day, starting at 6:30 in the morning. I would do the same thing on the way back when sports were with after school, and get home between 8 and 10. And did this for a number of years. By my junior year, my grandmother had developed Alzheimer's disease, had been placed into a nursing home. And my mother was now coming out of prison, no longer doing drugs, had gotten herself together. But she couldn't find a job. So my mother ended up turning to selling drugs to take care of us. And then my senior of high school, my mother ends up getting busted for selling drugs and was going her way back to prison again. And that's why I found myself eventually homeless. And friend and family allowed me to sleep on this floor until I graduated from high school. And I left Denver, Colorado, and I went to the University of Minnesota, and I never moved back. That was nearly 30 years ago, and I never moved back home.
Well, let me start with this question. Why do you think you didn't fall through the cracks? Because I know when and I was lucky, I had both parents at home, hardworking, with 8 siblings. But still, there was somebody who, you know, my parents did a great job of raising their children and whatnot. But there's still that somebody who needs, beyond your parents, who needs to turn on that switch. And for me, it was also a high school football coach. But not, okay, for me, not as an athlete, but as a student manager.
Sure.
And he looked at me and he said, if you do this, I just like your coach said, I can get you to college.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, that happened. But why do you think you didn't fall through the cracks? You know, because a lot of kids see what their parents do and do the same thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's 2 reasons. I think early on, I had a fear of being like my parents. So, however, I was headed down that pathway until 3rd grade. I wanted to join a gang in the neighborhood because all I had observed at this point was a lot of destruction and everything else. So there was a piece of me yearning for something, and the gangs looked very attractive. Well, my aunt got me involved in basketball, and basketball literally saved my life because it gave me something to shoot for. That was positive. And mm-hmm. once I got focused on basketball and sports, my goals and ambitions to get there were, that's all I focused on. You know, I was always a kid. I was telling someone the other day, my early years, my first year of birth, my mother was arrested 11 times between birth and age 1. So my early years were in foster homes and living with my grandmother. So around 4 or 5, I can remember my grandmother. And then shortly after that, moving back with my mother and father around 1st grade. And I remember getting to this apartment complex where we lived at in the inner cities, and all the kids would ride bikes. And of course, my parents weren't going to let me, they wouldn't give me a bike, and they weren't going to teach me how to ride a bike. So I found a yellow 10-speed, and you know, near the trash can in my neighborhood. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm going to learn how to ride this bike. Of course, the bike was too big, so I would get on people's cars and get on the bike and pedal, my feet barely hitting the pedals. Mm-hmm. And I taught myself how to ride a bike. And the issue was I didn't know how to stop the bike. So I would usually run into cars and trees to stop the bike, though. But I remember the words of my grandmother playing out in my life, that you got to be you got to have some get up and go to yourself. She always used to tell us that you got to have some get up and go. You always got to be a go-getter. So if there's something you want, you got to go get it. So I was never one to kind of sit back and wait for somebody to hand me something. If you just simply gave me a crack in the door, that was enough for me to go get it. So that's where I've always lived. And I tell a lot of our young people, sometimes it's not about someone handing or giving you something, but you being prepared for that little opportunity that may emerge and run through that door, and you got to go full speed. And sometimes you have to kick in the door or go over the door or build a new door. But whatever the case is, you got to have some get up and go about yourself. You can't sit back and just piss and moan and talk about how bad life is.
Well, yeah, that's definitely true. Then you somehow, and was it, and I'm trying to jog my memory here, was it Coach Wacker's staff that brought you here to the University?
Correct, yes. Yes, I was actually on my way to TCU where he was initially.
Okay.
And then he came to Minnesota. I recommitted from TCU and came to Minnesota.
And you get here and you must have thought, my God, where have I landed? Yeah.
It was cold. It was snow everywhere. You know, I came from Colorado. We had snow, but how, you know, the snow would usually melt in a couple of days. Minnesota right. never melted. It just kept coming and coming and coming and coming and coming and coming. So it was my first year in Minnesota was pretty difficult, you know. And then, you know, taper that with the fact that I was now a collegiate athlete. You know, in high school, usually when you got done with the season was over. Football was over with.
Right.
That wasn't the case in college. No, it was just starting. No. The off season was just starting. So I was like, what? We got to actually work out in the wintertime now and in the springtime and in the summer? Mm-hmm. It became a job. So, you know, adjusting right. to college sports was pretty tough.
But at that point, you must have thought, or what were you thinking? Man, I made it. Well, I need to keep fighting.
Nah, it was never a situation where I got to college, I thought I made it, because I was still slowly not too far removed from that lifestyle. I mean, even when I was going home for breaks and vacations, all my teammates were going home on flights. They were taking flights back to Texas and other places, and they were being welcomed to, you know, their old homes. And I was taking a Greyhound bus from Minnesota. It took me 22 hours
wow.
to get from Minnesota to Denver. Oftentimes I got home, I didn't have anywhere to stay, but I knew the 22-hour ride from Minnesota gave me a chance to have at least two nights
right.
to lay my head somewhere.
Yep.
So, and then when things got tough in Denver, I knew Greyhound, I could just show back up at the station, just come back to Minnesota whenever, come back and stay with friends or whatever. So oftentimes I didn't even have a home to return to in Denver. So it was never that I had arrived and I escaped, because, you know, I tell people dealing with homelessness is quite different than dealing with poverty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're dealing with homelessness, you don't have stable housing.
Right.
My friends who live in the projects, they were in poverty, and it was tough.
Right.
But they had somewhere that what they were going to every day. When you're living in motel rooms and shelters and stuff like that, you show up, you don't know when you're gonna pack up and have to go to another place. I remember in second grade, we're living in this motel room, JB. And we came to this motel room to return from the day, and my dad tried to put the key in the door, and the door wouldn't open up.
Right.
And the owner said, "Hey, get out of here," you know, or call the police. And of course, you know, my mom and dad were on drugs and they were doing illegal stuff, so they couldn't call the police. But nevertheless, what happened was they changed the lock on the door and they kept all of our stuff.
Wow.
So we literally had to go down the street, get back in the car, go down the street to the next motel room and start life all over again with what we had on our backs, you know. So when you're living in poverty, I mean, you're living in homelessness is quite different than living in poverty. So even though I was out of the situation physically in Denver, I was still being impacted at the collegiate level.
Well, you know, dealing with mean-spirited people, that was something you had to overcome too, because they could have kicked you out, but they could have let you have your stuff back.
Right, yeah. Absolutely. Well, at that point in time, my parents had not been paying rent, and they owed. So, you know, the rent due was business for him. He said, you didn't pay rent, so keeping your stuff, unfortunately.
Yeah, but still, that what little you did have meant a heck of a lot more than you guys than he could ever sell and get.
Absolutely.
Now, you weren't an only child, so were you the oldest?
I was number four, so there's six of us.
Okay.
So I had three siblings that were older than me, and I was number four of the oldest, and I had two younger siblings myself. So, you know, six of us, we never all lived together growing up as kids, because we were always either in different foster homes or separated. So we just never all lived together. Matter of fact, I met my oldest brother by pure coincidence in the second grade in a foster home. He just happened to be visiting with his adopted mom.
Right.
And my two older siblings happened to remember him. So you can imagine the mind-blowing reaction I had to discover that that was my brother who I had never met before in second grade. Yeah.
So when you were off here at the University of Minnesota, did it have a positive or negative effect on your remaining siblings?
You know what? I think it gave them a glimmer of accomplishment for their brother. I'm not sure that they were able to see it within themselves, but eventually they were able to see it in themselves. But I think there was a piece of them said, hey, he got out. Wow. Maybe, possibly, somehow, the same thing could happen for me, though. You know, But at the same time, though, my brothers were involved in gangs at the time. My sister was on crack cocaine. So I don't know necessarily that they fully understood what me leaving there physically was doing for me in my future. But I think they were happy that I did make it out at that point in time, though.
Tommy, and like we've known each other close to 30 years, and I'm really struggling to even to wrap my arms around the fact that you made it out. So and I know you're not trying to be depressing, and I'm not depressed. I'm more wild than anything, but it just, you know, and knowing you as long as I have, I've never knew a lot of the things you're telling me right now. So it's right. Like it's kind of mind blowing.
Yeah, and you know what? In fairness to you, no one did. You know, I got to the University of Minnesota. I mean, I vowed that no one was going to know my story. I wasn't going to talk about my story. I was going to simply go there, play football, go to the pros, make lots of money, and I was going to, you know, live life. But, you know, God always has other plans for me, and His plan was for me to come to grips with who I was, deal with my hurt and pain, and then use that hurt and pain to help other people, which is what I've been doing,
right?
You know, in this journey since then. So, but I definitely didn't have any intentions of sharing that story with anyone when I first arrived in Minnesota and Greenville. Yeah.
So when you with the place must have brought you some happiness. You know, you're living in a stable environment. You're safe. You know, dormitories, apartments.
Yeah.
How did that go? Because now you're in a, you know, because your second year you can live in an apartment. I don't know if you did or not.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, in fact, what coming to Minnesota did was it gave me exposure. It gave me a chance to expand my mind over and over again to other possibilities. However, as a second year, my teammates, so as freshmen, we all had to live in the dormitory.
Right.
Second year sophomores were able to move off campus. However, I did not.
Okay.
I stayed on campus all 5 years.
All right.
Because I never lived in a stable house that long. So I was making sure that Tommy Watson was going to be in the most stable environment for me to finish the University of Minnesota. So I never moved out of the dormitories. All my friends would laugh. They'd say, "Hey, you're a senior. What about all the freshmen?" I said, "That's okay. I got a steady meal.
Right.
I know I'm going to be sleeping at every day."
Yeah, because yeah, I was just wondering if that was a big change for you or if it was a fear. And it sounds like it might have been a little bit of a fear. So, you know, knowing that stableness of those dormitories, which people, if you've never been to a college dormitory, it's not the, you know, it's smaller than a studio apartment.
Absolutely. Yeah. No luxury in there whatsoever. You're in a twin bed.
Right.
Me and my twin bed, we were out there for 5 years as well. Yeah.
But then you must have been a leader if you were within that system, though. People must have looked up to you and whatnot.
Yeah, you know what? The funny thing is, maybe I couldn't necessarily say I call myself a leader, but I was a person who was always driven by principles. I always was driven by relationships. I always stood firm to the things I believed in. And I was a person who worked hard. You know, once I got it, I worked hard. I'm just coming off a trip in Houston, Texas, where I met up with 20 of my former teammates, you know, from...
Yeah, I saw that, those University photos.
Yeah. So to stay connected with all those teammates for nearly 30 years, man, absolutely incredible. You know, but for the most part, when I travel places, I run into, you know, my former teammates, and we all have a good time. You know, so I was always been big on building relationships and looking out for other people, and in turn, people have appreciated that. And they didn't know my story. You know, one of the things that people kept saying this weekend was, "Man, I didn't know you were going through that. I didn't know you were going through that," because I was actually down there speaking as well, and a number of them came out to hear me speak. You know, and they were like, "Wow, I didn't know that." But I see now why you were saying that, you know, because I was a person who I didn't follow, you know, I've never drank alcohol or anything else like that.
Right.
To this day, I've never done it. So when, you know, we went out places, they would bring me apple juice and everyone would laugh, but they were saying, "I see why you did. I see why now, you know, your grandmother died from alcoholism and your two uncles died from it as well. So I get it now, you know, your mom died from drugs." Yeah. So, yeah. So it's amazing.
So you make it through, you graduate, and then you must think, okay, now I do actually have to move out of the dorms and make a living. What were you thinking at that point?
Well, for me, I knew I didn't have any safety nets. So I knew education was going to be, the more education I got, I knew I was going to get more stable. So I went and got four college degrees, including my doctor of education. because I said the more education I got was going to open up doors for opportunities for me, and I had no one to rely on if things didn't work out for me in Minnesota. So I really maximized that, and I became a school principal and began to turn and have that impact on other young people as well, in particular young people coming from my same circumstance, letting them know that, hey, because you're there does not mean for one second that you have to stay there. So, you know, in my school district, I had the largest number of homeless kids in the district attending my school. And I took great pride in making sure that even the kids who were in situations where the parents divorced and they had to go, you know, move to another city, that I still sent the school bus to get them, because in that instance, I wanted the school to be the most stable thing in the environment, no matter what was going on at home. I had a kid who was riding an hour away, you know, coming to school, at least staying on the bus, you know. So I took great pride in doing that. I met with those kids who were homeless every month, once a month, and the joy on their face, the hope that I gave them, you know, knowing that their principal was in their shoes, was absolutely amazing. And you know, I thank God that I was able to be able to have an impact on them. And again, I would not want to go back and live the circumstance I lived before, but I thank God that I went through them, so I was able to take that mess and create a message out of it to help other young people thrive.
So where was that? What was the location?
So my school was in Brooklyn Center, near a lot of the local unrest that's been taking place in the city of Brooklyn Center. And matter of fact, the former mayor of Brooklyn Center, Mike Elliott, was one of my mentees when I was in Minnesota as well. So happy to see his leadership as well.
Well, clearly you had a hand in helping a lot of people there. But as you were going through the U and receiving your degrees, did that have any effect on your, again, going back to your younger siblings?
You know what? I think they eventually learned to appreciate what I did, because there were so many people in our neighborhood who didn't do it. It was easier to join the gang. You know, I had to tell a lot of people, it was easy. I could have joined the Crips, you know, it would have been easy. You know, that was easy. Going against the tide is a lot tougher, you know.
Right.
And I think they're realizing it now that, hey, man, when you were taking those three city buses to school and you're playing, you know, basketball senior of high school with your toe coming out of your shoe because you didn't have any money, and then all the homies around me, all my friends from middle school who are now selling drugs and gangbanging, had thousands and thousands of dollars, new cars and everything else and fancy clothes, but yet and still – I didn't turn to that lifestyle. I played my games my senior year of high school. I've been the top basketball player on my team with my big toe coming out of my shoes because I didn't have any money.
So that must have been, you know, devastating in some ways. But I guess I'm wondering, are your siblings okay? Did they also survive?
Yeah, you know, it's great because now my younger sister, my younger brother who was involved in gangs pretty heavily, has, you know, created him a business. He's doing very well. He actually lives here in Charlotte, North Carolina. My younger sister lives in Charlotte, North Carolina as well. She's doing well. Unfortunately, my older sister passed away from cancer last year.
Okay.
And my older brother, he's doing well in Denver as well, and my second older sister as well. So I'm really happy seeing the transition they've all made and the success they're making. Great parents, great uncles, and so I'm really happy for them.
So do you think your story played any part in their success? Because I know in my family, my parents, my dad only had an eighth grade education, and my mother had a year of community college, but education, you know, was always preached to the nine children. And as one graduated from high school, it seems like the college level kept raising and kept raising and kept raising.
Sure.
You think you played any part in their success?
You know, JB, I would say it's possible, but to me, really, I don't necessarily care if I did or didn't. I just love the fact that they're doing better today. And I don't know if it's life that just kind of dawned on them, or if it was me, but whatever the case is, that the end result for them, they're doing better. That's all that matters to me more than anything. And we're able to connect as siblings because, again, despite what I've been able to accomplish, I'm still just their brother. They're brother.
Yes.
And they're my sister and brother. So none of that stuff counts at all when we're just connecting as family members. It's about the relationship. Yeah.
So you're now stable, very stable, You know, you're motivating young minds. You don't have to worry about a roof over your house and any of those things. Where did the light bulb come on to start motivational speaking?
You know what? I was a principal about 11 years ago, and I felt that there was a call in my life to just simply motivate people with my story. And I walked away from my $120,000 a year principal job, and I said, I'm gonna figure this thing out. It wasn't about the money, but as much as it was about freedom and just having a message to encourage people. And I took a risk on myself. I've always been a person who's been right. willing to risk on myself. And I jumped out there 11 years ago, JB, and never turned back. You know, and since that time, I've been able to just take and utilize my story in terms and not just speaking, but, you know, through books, through movies. You know, most recently I had an award-winning movie that's won seven awards, and now I've created a TV series and feature movie that I'm hoping to eventually have produced here in the near future as well. So, you know, I'm just banking on myself. I've always been an individual who's never doubted my abilities. Not that I was always a person who was overly talented or a good student or anything like that, but I always, you know, found a way to believe in myself despite what was going on, and that's what I continue to do.
So how does somebody who was mostly homeless as a youth graduate from college, have a stable life, pull himself away and take that chance of going back to that? Or did you think, well, if this doesn't work, at least I have enough education to go back and do something?
Yeah, well, for me, it was never about going back. So once I left Minnesota principalship, I gave up all my tenure. I gave up everything. It was all looking forward. It was the same thing I did as a third grader. When I moved away from joining the Crips to, you know, striving to go play in the NFL and NBA. I'm an all-in kind of person. So once I'm in, I'm in. So the motivation, I wouldn't just say motivational speaking is just one aspect of what I do. I also do executive coaching and consulting as well. I'm an author. So there's multiple streams of things that I do in addition to being a motivational speaker. I talked to other entrepreneurs. I left my job as a principal to get their insights and get their blueprint. And, you know, being an entrepreneur and a speaker requires me every day to strive to get better. I can't wake up any day striving for average or mediocrity. So I'm constantly striving for greatness. I'm constantly working hard. I'm constantly looking for blueprints of other individuals who have been there, done that, and learning from what they've done and taking and tweaking it to make it work for myself. And it's pretty exciting. You know, some people maybe would be fearful about that, but I get pretty excited about the opportunities that come with and the risks that come with, you know, being an entrepreneur.
Well, some people would say you pulled the old adage, you pulled yourself up from your bootstraps. How do you see that happening now with all the stuff that this nation has faced in the past year and a half, and all the things that have gone on from a pandemic to race relations reawakening to cancel culture to a lot that's been going on lately?
You know, one thing I would say that even though I was able to come a long ways, I also had a lot of people like my grandmother who stepped into the plate to help me out. I had my older sister, even though she was a crack addict. My older sister, I love her to death. She's mm-hmm. not here today. Rest in peace. She was my hero. My aunt stepped in, you know, coaches stepped in. So I think that's pretty important. So in terms of what was happening in our nation today, though, I think we all have to be what my grandmother said, all you know, you got to have some get up and go about yourself. Even though we're coming off a tough year, get up and go was about having hope. Right. So you have to have an element of optimism. And the acronym I like to use for hope is have only positive expectations. So even coming off of a year 2020 when things are tough, we have to turn to a place where we have only positive expectations. We believe that things are going to work out and be better. We have to believe that race relationships in our nation can improve. We have to believe that relationship with police can improve. We have to believe that this virus is going to someday go by the wayside and we're going to go back to normal. I was telling someone the other day, you know, I remember growing up, JB, and you probably heard the same thing, with kids talked about chicken pox, right?
Right.
When was the last time you heard about a kid having chicken pox? I can't tell you. My kids have never had chicken pox. The doctors don't even talk to them about chicken pox, you know?
Right.
I had chicken pox when I was a senior in high school. So someday this virus will be a distant memory in our past. We have to do all the things that we're being told by the CDC and other experts to help our nation get through it. And then we also have to believe that as a country that we can get to a place where we're able to heal and come together and do better. And I also challenge a lot of our African Americans out there as well, though. I said that we have to become more economically independent, which is, I think, is very, very important.
Yes.
Right now we are high consumers. We get, we spend a lot of our money on liabilities, not assets. You know,
right. One
of the great stories I came across recently was a 28-year-old single parent mom who got a stimulus check. She turned that stimulus check into a $1.3 million coaching program. That's what I'm talking about.
Right.
We got to do. You know,
yeah, that's,
you know,
wonderful.
That's financial independence, because right now you can't. It's hard. It's hard to look at the people who feed you every day and ask for them to treat you differently. We want them to treat us differently,
right?
But the same people who feed you can starve you as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to get to a place where we're not worried about them feeding us or starving us. We're able to coexist economically with other groups of people as well. We don't have to necessarily be jealous of anyone. And us coming up, rising to that place, doesn't necessarily take away from anyone else. It just says we as African Americans, we got to do better to get that economic independence, where we can get a lot of our own folks in various offices and demand that, you know, we're going to be treated and seen as human beings like everyone else.
Well, about the time that you were playing football at the U, I was working in a team homeless program in Minneapolis.
Wow.
And we would meet every Wednesday, and we would talk about our case loads and whatnot. And me and another individual would, when it was our time to talk, we would talk, you know, you talked about how the kids in your caseload were doing and trying to get stable, you know, either get them returned to the household. If you can't, then some other services. And if they were old enough, find housing for themselves. You know, we had a component that actually helped find their own apartment and whatnot, which is, you know, it's a struggle amongst itself to keep them there.
Absolutely.
But we talked to me and this other, his name was Randy. We always, when we talked about our case, we always talked about what they were doing.
Yes.
Whereas everybody else talked about what they were doing for the kids. And it was like,
yes.
And finally he just stepped up one day and he said, "Do you not hear what he's saying?" And they're like, what are you talking about? What he's saying is, he's not doing anything.
Yeah.
He might be there to give a little advice and whatnot. His kids are doing
right.
it because they're learning what to do and how
That's
to
right.
do it.
And teaching them how to fish. Yes.
Right.
Absolutely.
Where they were teaching their caseload how to be dependent on them.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's a dangerous thing, because time runs out on that eventually.
Yes.
You know, because when they hit 18, I think the age was, or 19, we couldn't work with them anymore. And in some cases, all we did was teach them how to be, you know, to live or exist off what we could do for them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Keeping them dependent on the system. And, you know, part of what bothered me about Minnesota sometimes was the whole concept of, there's a lot of great people up there, a lot of good people. But there was this notion of, I need to save you in
yes.
every situation when it came to working with kids, where that's not necessarily the case in the South. I remember my aunt from Chicago who moved to Chicago, she's from Little Rock, Arkansas, moved to Chicago. She said, when you had a baby in the South, you know, you had to figure things out, you know?
Right.
And when you had to figure things out with that baby as a young mother, you probably didn't have any more kids because it was pretty tough on you, you know? So, you know, sometimes that giving people fish all the time, there are times where people definitely need that helping hand. Absolutely.
Oh,
we should do it completely. But there are other times where we're extending that helping hand a little bit too far, and we're making people far too dependent on systems, which was the case that I'd observe a lot in Minnesota. Some of it in the South, but for the South, for the most part, you know, it's a little different mindset around government resources and stuff like that.
And I still run into that as a 59-year-old man. People think they need to save me. And, you know, and I was in a interview process where I was part of the team that was interviewing somebody. And they said, he asked, what could he do for me if he got the job? And I looked at him and said, stay out of my way. And everybody kind of looked at me and thought that was rude. It's like, no, I know what my job takes to do.
Absolutely.
We need to hire somebody and bring them up to speed so they can do their job.
That's right.
And so I totally get that. And for, you know, like you said, Minnesota is a wonderful place and they're very charitable. But then that's where that tag, and it has many meanings here in Minnesota. Minnesota Nice comes into.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when they're helping those people, it's not totally about helping those people.
Right.
Part of it is making themselves feel good.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why I felt it was the case a lot, JB. You know, it was a lot of almost in certain situations, kind of white guilt.
Yes.
As I could save you, right, that kind of conquers the guilt that I may have that you're not necessarily be doing as well, versus saying, hey, you know, let me open up a door for you to, you can do the same thing I can do. I don't need to save you. You know, you're more than capable. You know, it was the same thing in the school system. You know, oftentimes, right, a lot of educators that didn't believe in the kids just because of the color of skin. I'm saying, no, the kids can do it if you just simply believe in them.
Right.
Be the guy for them and then get out of the way. They can do it.
You know, give them the tools, but also give them expectations. You know, absolutely, me, Tommy, I always had expectations for my athletes.
Absolutely.
And if you guys didn't meet them, you know, maybe I said something, maybe I didn't say something, but right, you could tell probably from my face or my body language if I was disappointed in you that day.
Yeah.
And a lot of people in Minnesota take that as me being angry or being, mm-hmm, me being intimidating, which I, mm-hmm, have to laugh. It's like, you know, some of us wear our emotions on our sleeves.
Sure.
No, it's a different thing if I was yelling and cursing and whatnot and threatening.
Right.
But I wasn't. So,
absolutely.
But that's a different story for a different day. So you now made the transition where you made that heavy decision, or maybe it wasn't a heavy decision, of this is what I'm due and this. So how did you make it happen?
I spend a lot of time talking to other people. You know, sometimes you can shorten your learning curve in life when it comes to accomplishing your goals and dreams by simply talking to other people and learning their road to success. So I spend a lot of time speaking to other people, talking to other people, and putting in the hard work to get there, and taking what people perceive as a risk. You know, oftentimes it's a bigger risk working for someone else who can fire you at any point in time than, you know, jumping out there on your own.
Right.
Doing the things that can make you, you know, successful based upon your own merit as well. So spend a lot of time talking to other people, you know, a lot of great former greats like Walter Bond, Desi Williamson.
Mm-hmm.
When I left the University of Minnesota, giving me a lot of good insights in terms of what it's going to take to become an entrepreneur. One of the best things Desi Williamson told me that I kept in mind over the years was, he said, he was a motivational speaker at the time. Desi Williamson is a Hall of Fame motivational speaker. He told me, he said, Tommy, do not just become a motivational speaker. He said, become a businessman who does motivational speaking. That was the most profound advice I ever gotten. So what he was saying, diversify yourself.
Right.
Have other streams of income, things that you do, and let speaking be just a part of other things that you do, mm-hmm, as a business person. That was profound. And that's what I do today. Speaking is just another part of the many things I do.
Yeah, I totally understand that. I was part of a radio show in town for 22 years. I was doing that when you guys were playing.
Mm.
And, you know, that comes to an end. Even though it was a top-rated morning show at one point in the country per capita.
Sure.
And from there, I stepped away from broadcasting, and then I became a part of somebody else's podcast for 3-4 years. And he kept saying, and somebody else amongst the show kept saying, you need to do your own.
Yeah.
And I took it as, you need to go away. And it was like, you know, didn't take it well.
Sure.
And as we were going through the pandemic and whatnot, it finally hit me what they meant. You are good enough to do this on your own. Go
absolutely
do it.
And absolutely,
that's when I started researching what I needed. bugging people on how to put it together. And, you know, I started it in November 2020. And
man, congratulations.
Well, thanks. Yeah. But I totally get what you and Desi are saying, because I didn't give up my full-time job because I need that income. And I actually started my own equipment repair business.
Wow, from that's awesome.
From the tools that I learned while I worked in athletics at the university. So so I totally understand that. So with your businesses, and what can you go through again what you're dipping your toes into? Well, I shouldn't even say dipping your toes in. You jumped into fully.
Sure. So I do executive coaching. So I'm an executive and professional coach certified, ISCP, ISCF, I'm sorry, coach as well. I do consulting. Of course, I'm an author as well. I do a lot of speaking in addition to that. And then I just jumped into the field of executive movie producing here for the last 2 years as well. And even became a rapper. Can you believe that, JB? I rapped my theme song for my movie. I did it one time. It was a one-time deal. It was very tough. Rapping was a lot more work than I thought it would be.
Right.
But I tell kids, you can become a rapper and a doctor at the same time. So
right.
Doing a little bit of everything. And now, you know, doing some course creation as well. So looking forward to that.
Tom, I'm gonna be honest with you. I never knew until I did a little research on you for today's interview, the word doctor was in front of your name.
Wow.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's okay. You know, and for me, I'm a very humble guy. Mm-hmm. And that accomplishment is I give glory to God for it. And it was very personal for me to become Dr. Watson, more so for me to accomplish it than to have other people necessarily call me it. So,
right.
Yeah, so it's been great.
Now, we have your story and whatnot, and before we get to what are you going to do in the future, for some reason it's just I'm just thinking with what the young people have gone through and, you know, your background in education, are you doing a lot of speaking with young people right now, especially in the African-American, Latino, X, Native American, maybe even some Asian culture?
Sure. I've done a lot of speaking over this past year. A lot of it has been virtual. So I've done a lot of that. And I actually just spoke to an organization in Minnesota here virtually the other day called Turning Point, which is an organization that helps turn the lives around of individuals who have been incarcerated and individuals who are dealing with substance abuse. So they're doing a phenomenal job. So it's been amazing to be able to take and share this story and give hope and inspiration to those students, adults, colleges. I've spoken to colleges over the years, corporations. It's been very exciting, and it's even been more exciting to be able to do it from my home as well.
So when you talk directly to youth, do you hear kids maybe say, "I can't do this," or maybe ask, "How can I do this?"
Yeah. Well, typically what happens with me, I'll bring students in, I'll speak to them, and then after hearing my story, they hear a story that's very similar to their own story. They see a person who's been where they've been to. So I think versus saying, "I can't do this," I think a lot of them begin to believe it's possible for me to do that. And then they'll ask the questions, how? Mm-hmm. And a lot of my advice to them now as youth is to maximize the one thing that they control. You can't control things that are happening at home.
Right.
But the piece you can control is what you do. So my senior of high school, I lived in 5 different locations and was homeless. But you know how many days of school I missed that time, JB?
I would guess knowing
zero.
You. I was going to say knowing you, Tommy, none.
Zero. Wasn't late for any days of school. My grades were horrible. I had a 1.5, 1.75. So I was struggling in school because all the stuff that was taking place at home. Mm-hmm. But I kept going to school every day.
Right.
So I tell kids, keep getting that education. Education becomes a game changer in many situations. And then work on your mindset. Believe that you have the power to create your own reality. It may not necessarily happen today, but you keep what you can take. The manifestation that happens with you is you take what's in your mind and you create it in your future. And this is the piece that I told people here recently. It was a study by researchers that they did on the brains of actors. Mm-hmm. And they looked at actors when the actors were in their role. And the MRI machine showed that the actors, when they were in their character role, their brains actually changed. So I tell people, your ability to have a vision for your future changes your brain. And your brain doesn't know the difference between fiction and reality. Your brain right. simply goes to what you tell it to do. So even in a place of daunting despair, you can still dream about something that's bigger and better. I was in that motel room with 9 people. I never dreamed about that particular day. I was always dreaming about something in the future. So you have to dream, and your brain will respond to it. So you have the ability to create your own reality.
All this sounds like it's been a calling from the time that you were in those hotel rooms.
Yes.
And, excuse me, you were able to keep pushing. Where's that synergy or that energy to do that come from?
It just connects. We all been put on this earth for a passion and a purpose and a reason. I discovered my why 11 years ago, which was to simply inspire people using my story and teach them the lessons I learned about resiliency. And once I tapped into that, I said, this is something I want to do every day. You know, so there's no day that I get up and I say, I have to go to work. And I'm blessed. I get up every day excited about the opportunity to do one more thing to make one other person's life a little bit better. So I get excited about it. It's a blessing to be doing it. And to live your purpose and your calling and your passion, have it all tied together, is an amazing place to be in this world.
So have you had the opportunity to come back to your old stomping grounds and give speeches or talks? Or
you know, I spoke several times there when Coach Kiel was there. I haven't done anything recently.
Okay.
Hopefully in the future, that'll be something we'll be willing to do.
Yeah, I'm going to have to get on Norris Wilson, who's the player development person on campus. He's a former Gopher athlete too.
Absolutely.
And a great story amongst himself, being the first African American head coach in the Ivy League at one point.
Wow.
So
wow.
Yeah. He was awesome. he has an interesting story himself. I remember when he came on campus as a freshman. We couldn't. He was so large. We couldn't weigh him on a normal scale. We had to weigh him on a laundry scale, 364. The coaches were smart enough to turn him over to the wrestling program and got him down to 272.
Wow, that's amazing. That's incredible.
And became this hulk of this nimble-footed offensive tackle.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah,
that's amazing.
Do you have any, or what is your future endeavors?
Well, a big part of what I'm going to be doing now is going to be teaching people, how to take their stories and build multiple streams of income as an entrepreneur with them. And then hopefully, get a lot of those folks to see the value in, taking their story and maybe producing to a movie similar to mine, you know, won 7 awards. But I'm also going to be doing some things with my TV series and my feature movie as well. So hopefully we'll have them produced and you'll see them on a screen or a television near you sometime in the near future.
So you've written, was it, how many books?
So I've written 3 books, 4 include my dissertation so far, yes.
Okay.
2 of them are out, yes.
All right. What's the name of those?
So A Face of Courage is the story about my personal life. Resilience of Champions is the story about the lessons I learned from it. And then, of course, if people are interested in looking at some of my doctoral work on Black male doctors and how teachers motivate them to stay successful as students, they can certainly Google Tommy Watson dissertation to find that out. And then I have another book that I'll be coming out with soon that just teaches people the importance of having multiple streams of income.
Right.
To go after your goals and dreams, because you know one source of income is a scary place to be nowadays.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, let's face it, Tommy. I'm on that path to retirement, and that's why I started this, and definitely why I started the equipment repair business, because that's something I can go sit, definitely go sit in a corner and do.
Absolutely.
And at my pace, and have that, still have some other stream of income outside of what retirement funds I have.
Absolutely. That's a smart gig, smart move.
and your films, titles?
So the feature movie is called Resilient. The TV series is called Resilient Below Poverty. People say, what's below poverty? Below poverty is homelessness.
Right.
So the TV series will be one that will shed light on the issue of childhood homelessness in our country.
And where can that be seen?
Well, it's at the very beginning stages of being completed as a script now. So it'll be a matter of working with partners and raising funds and all the other stuff that kind of goes in with getting a movie created. So which I'm very excited to venture down that avenue to get this process going. But the scripts have been written and they are being receiving great reviews so far.
Any connections or hopes to make connection with major networks?
Well, I am looking to partner with them. I'm not necessarily looking to sell my story or anything like that. So those networks that are looking to partner with them, I'm going to be doing that. Also would like to have them produced in Atlanta, because Atlanta is a great place, not too far from me, in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Right.
A lot of black cinema is taking place. And Atlanta has the areas that are very similar to my area in Denver, Colorado. And we have a number of former players, and we have, you know, you actually have Karan Riley, who's an actor who's
yes,
in Atlanta as well. So I'm going to have to tap him to see if he's interested in the role in the movie as well.
Well, there's also an individual, Bruce Holmes, who played before you here at the U. He's a politician in Atlanta.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. You should, I can put you in contact with Bruce. So
we'd love to, yeah, make that connection. We'd love to meet him.
Right. Yeah, he was recruited by Lou Holtz, and he played for John Gutekunst. And Bruce, it was interesting to find. I have a brother who also lives in Atlanta. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, but it was weird to find out that Bruce knew my brother, and I was like, huh? Excuse me?
Wow.
So.
Wow.
Yeah, that must have been an interesting meeting when they found out that they had me in common. So.
Yeah, I'd definitely love to meet him. Absolutely.
I'm going to get a little political here with you for a second. You speaking about doing some things in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
Does the voter, what they're trying to change with the voter rights down in Atlanta, does that make you nervous at all, or what are your thoughts?
I think it's something we have to be mindful of. I think what Georgia did shows, as we as African Americans in this country, we carry an incredible amount of political leverage as well,
right,
in our vote.
Yes, we do.
And what they did in Georgia, Stacey Abrams and others, and again, I'm not a Democrat or a Republican,
okay,
what they did was they simply said, hey, we just can't win Atlanta and the other major areas. We have to get blacks out to vote in these rural areas that typically either vote Republican or don't vote at all. And what it showed was, as a collective group, when we come together, no one can stop us. You know, so if these other southern states begin to do the same things, like Mississippi and Louisiana and others, it's going to have create a domino effect there as well. So, you know, what they're doing politically is very unfortunate, but it's something we have to be mindful of, because they know, they've witnessed something that they didn't think could actually ever happen,
right,
where the black vote came together to make the difference in that state and around the country and other places as well. So we have to know that we carry a lot of political power when it comes to our vote. So we have to get out there and vote, no matter who you vote for, Republican or Democrat or independent, get out there and vote, let your voice be heard, and vote for the best person for the job, male or female, doesn't matter, ethnic background or anything else, though, but just get the best people in office that are going to be the best thing for the American people.
Yeah, it was an interesting dichotomy in the sense. Blacks, with the help of a lot of whites, elected a black president, but blacks helped elect a white president.
Absolutely.
And two senators in that state.
Absolutely.
Stacey Abrams, who ran for governor herself, and they're thinking that she may run again.
Absolutely.
Energized a whole area, and it's funny watching the response to that, you know, can't give people water while they're in line. You can't do this. Right. You can't give them a ride. You can't. It's like, clearly you're trying to put hurdles in front of people who have a ton of hurdles in their way to begin with.
Yeah. And, you know, the irony that it took place in Georgia, Atlanta is probably the most prosperous city in the nation for African Americans. You have a ton of black millionaires. You have a ton of black superstars. Mm-hmm. You have all this influential folks there. And all those folks and their voices and everything else came together to make the difference in Georgia. Georgia, if they continue that same momentum and effort, numbers-wise, and unless a particular party does something different to attract new people to their party, or they change the laws to mitigate the voting rights of others, they can't win.
Right.
But I wish that people in this country would see that it's about relationships and not necessarily about suppressing the votes of others, but having genuine relationships with
right.
people. And that's what opens up doors for the political advantage.
Yeah, it's a weird dichotomy, because when slaves were freed, and, you know, I get the whole economic piece to that, why it happened. It was to take the power base away from the South.
Sure.
But they were Republicans.
Absolutely.
And now you now have Republicans throwing everything they can to stop African Americans and Latinx and Native
right.
Americans and in some ways, Asian Americans from voting. And
yeah.
I just find that and I have that discussion with friends who look at me and say, why did you vote for Democrat this time? I said, because
mm-hmm.
They gave me hope. And going
yeah.
back to what you were saying about hope, and they weren't trying to hurt me, and they weren't partnering with people who clearly hate me
right.
because of the color of my skin.
Right. You know, the other thing is that there are people in this country, their allegiance is not to a political party, it's not to America. Their allegiance is white supremacy. That's what
right.
their allegiance is to. And
mm-hmm.
they'll use the mask, the smoke screen of Christianity. They'll use the smoke screen
yep.
of America, the flag, and all this stuff. But at the end of the day, it's not really about those things.
No.
It's about something different and more divisive that hurts not only just African Americans and other minority groups, but hurts all people in our country.
Yes.
Because whenever you have a system set up where certain groups of people get advantages and others don't, they're not building resiliency. So I tell people, one of the issues that, you know, people found in the South is you have had a lot of large number of African Americans over the years who've had to fight, scratch, tooth and nail to go to college and everything else. And while there's a certain group of people who've kind of sat back and rested in laurels. So you see these people now rising up. You see these historically black colleges. My daughters have all gone to black colleges. They're getting degrees and everything else. And now these other groups of people who had all these advantages and privileges put in place are now falling behind. Yes, they're screaming, make America great again. But if they simply got in the game
mm-hmm.
and started using the blueprint that other people are using to go to school, work hard, and build relationships, become entrepreneurs, and not be so protective over this illusion that they once had in the country, America would become a better place for all of us. But there are groups of people who simply just want the advantages and privileges of being a certain color to be the thing that elevates them to be successful in this country. That's not enough, because we're now in a global society where people from all around the world are competing against you. And it's not just enough to be able to somebody hand you a bunch of privileges and advantages. You got to be able to work hard just like everyone else. If you don't, it doesn't work.
Like you said, you have to cling to hope. You have to cling to people that give hope. You have to educate yourself. And, I mean, I go back to my father's mother. One of the last things she did on this earth was vote.
Wow.
Go back to my dad. One of the last things he did on this earth was to vote.
That's right.
For the first time in years, decades, because he became disenfranchised and disillusioned.
Sure.
He voted for Barack Obama. Because mm-hmm. he said he never thought he would have even the opportunity
That's right.
to vote for an African American.
That's right.
And he wanted to make sure that happened. But that's the right. One thing I really cling to is my mother said, you have that right, and you are to, it is your duty.
That's right.
As a U.S. citizen to do it. And me and my siblings to this day, not only vote, we make sure that our children vote, but that's not right. Only that, we make sure people in our communities vote.
Absolutely.
So we don't
that
tell
is
them.
The name of the game.
We don't tell them who to vote for. We just tell them to get out and
just
vote.
Just get out there.
Because yeah. By doing that, it brings power to yourself, number one, but to mm-hmm. your community. And it's just a very powerful thing.
Mm-hmm.
With wrapping up with this, Tommy, people don't know this. We talked about it. Tommy and I had a timing screw up, and it was totally me because I didn't read his message correctly. Tommy's now on the East Coast, which I didn't think he was. I thought for some reason you were still out west or maybe down in Texas. So I truly apologize for that, but I'm very, very happy that we connected. I'm so honored that you were giving of your time today, and I'm so proud to play a teeny, teeny, tiny part in the success of what is Tommy Watson. As I, ran around behind you guys and said, "Hey, make sure you get your education. Make sure you get your education."
That was a significant role, and I appreciate you doing that as well because that was vital for many of us. Make sure we get that education, though. So I appreciate that role was far bigger than being teeny. Absolutely.
So in closing, is there a message you want to impart on my listeners and to wrap this up?
Yeah. So first of all, if people want to get a hold of me, you can go to tawatson.com.
Yes.
And get all my information there. I just want to leave you with these thoughts here that, again, you have the ability to create your own reality. So if you're at a place in life right now, you're not necessarily happy with what's going on, change your thoughts because your thoughts create your reality. If you want to manifest something different, if what you're manifesting right now in life and what you're producing in life right now is not pleasing to you, manifest new thoughts. Because if you look around everywhere you are, even right now, look around everything around you, that's a thing was created from someone's mind. You have the ability to do the same thing. Our thinking creates our reality. And never, ever forget that.
So, again, how do they contact you, Tommy?
I go to tawatson.com.
T.A. Watson.
All my contact is, tawatson.com. All my contact information is there, email, telephone number, and everything else. Social media is there as well.
Okay.
And I would love to reach out to anyone who has, in particular, if anyone has any contacts in the movie industry, contact me. I'd love to connect with you about that as well.
And I'll pass that information on to his name again is Bruce Holmes. He's he's a council person, I believe, in that's his title down in Atlanta or a suburb of Atlanta.
And we'd love to connect with him. Yeah.
Yeah. He's on, you're both on my Facebook page. So, and he's doing great things just like you are. Again, Tommy, thank you for your time. And ladies and gentlemen, again, this has been Dr. Tommy Watson here on the JB's Low Tech Podcast.
Well, folks, the season is finally here. What season? Baseball and softball season, of course. Are you ready? What about you players out there? Are you ready? Is your equipment ready? What about that glove you've been using? What about that uniform you've been wearing year after year? Well, I tell you what, if it needs to be repaired, bring it to JB's Glove Repair. He'll have you together in no time. That's JAYBEES Glove Repair. With over 30 plus years of experience, he'll have you ready by game time. That's JAYBEES Glove Repair.
JB is my name, and f***ing up motherfuckers is my game.
Right on. Negro, black, African American.
Black.
Django.
JB.
Damn, Dolomite.
Great God in heaven, you know.
JB.
Our great Negro sex machine.